I have been a member of the Aiken UU congregation since 2004. For those of you who are UUs in the audience, I thought you'd appreciate that. Also a member of the UU congregation here, we have Dr. David Crockett. He is a professor in advertising at the Darla Moore School of Business, USC, and he focuses on consumer behavior and also issues of inequality with gender, class, and race. That is a research focus of his. Then we have Megan Kane, a history professor at Benedict College and also editor of Antebellum. And finally, we have Ty DePass, who describes himself as New York to the bone. He's been a grassroots organizer since the age of 15, and I won't tell you how long that's been, but maybe he wants to do that. Now he is down here in Columbia, South Carolina, and part of Simple Justice Black Lives Matter, the local official Black Lives Matter chapter. And finally, we have our moderator, Richard McLeod, who is a member of the UU congregation here. And Richard is a retired school administrator. And when he first began his 40-year career as a school administrator, he was at a newly desegregated school, high school in Lee County. And when he retired, unfortunately, Lee County still faces serious issues of inequity, but he has seen that firsthand. So without further ado, we'll hand it over to Richard.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I have to admit, and kind of shamedly, I suppose, that this speech, this anti-Vietnam speech that Dr. King made, happened just a month before I graduated from college. And I was sequestered there for a number of years and really didn't get the impact of his work. So I wish I could go back and be more of a weekend warrior. At any rate, let me tell you about these questions that we've received today. Lots of them, and we're never going to get through them all. So what we've done is we've gone through and tried to categorize some of them together. Some of them were less questions than they were comments, and so we appreciate that too. And they will fold in to the questions well. No particular order here except as I threw them up and they landed. So we'll see if we can make that work. First question, David Matos. What was your objective in bringing people together today to watch this movie?
Well, you know, I first heard about this speech through a fellow UU who's passed on since. His name is Jack Urich. He was a member of our Aiken UU congregation. And, you know, Jack was very keen on this speech. And about the same time that he was bringing my attention to the speech, I realized that everything that King talked about in the speech is just as relevant today. The big takeaway from the speech, beyond Vietnam, is he calls for this revolution of values. He says that we're going to keep on marching, we're going to keep on having these concerned clergy committees and things like that unless we deal with the at-heart problem with America, and that we put profit and money before people. And we need to have a revolution in values. So that's a big thing. As a peace activist, I see everything that he talked about fighting communism, that the U.S. wasn't doing it the right way. That's a second thing. In that, you know, we were fighting communism, but he called that a negative communism of using violence, rather that instead of there should be a positive anti-communism of doing it better and doing setting a better example. And that's very applicable today to our war on terrorism. We have this idea that we can't bomb our way out of terrorism. So what can we do? We need to do the right thing and show the right example, and that's the better way of us fighting terrorism. So if you just remove the word communism and replace it with terrorism in the speech, it's just as relevant today. And that's one of the big takeaways I had from that. So those were the goals of me. I've been talking about this speech for a long time, and that's really where I was trying to go, to bring people in on this critique and to see that, you know, it is as relevant today. And we're still going to continue our mistakes until we take this lesson and this blueprint that Dr. King gave us to heart.
All right. Thank you, David. Now, that question was particularly pointed toward David, but some of the others are just questions that could be answered by any of you. So I think I'm going to let you make the choice if you just raise your hand about who wants to answer this particular question. What would Martin Luther King think about Black Lives Matter? I had a conservative Facebook person comment that he would be disappointed of them and disapprove. And I commented, maybe I didn't. What do you think? Who wants to take this one? Ty?
Oh, boy. I've hit that before from folks. I've had people say, prove to me that Black Lives Matter is relevant and that Dr. King, they always throw Dr. King in. And it's always that 35 words from the middle of the I Have a Dream speech. What they miss is that the main speech was talking about a promissory note that had gone unpaid and an interview that he said, we're going to D.C. to get a paycheck. Dr. King was not nonviolent in the sense of, you know, peace at any cost. In fact, the thing about the Riverside Church speech that really strikes me is that that's not the first time he dealt with those themes. In 1956, at the pulpit of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, at the height of the Montgomery bus boycott, and the day before he was going to go on trial, he talked about this concept of peace, that everybody was saying you need to be peaceful, you need to give the state a chance. He said peace is not merely the absence of some negative force, war, tension, confusion, but the presence of some positive force, justice, goodwill, the power of the kingdom of God. Then he went on to say, if peace means accepting second-class citizenship, I don't want it. If peace means keeping my mouth shut in the midst of injustice and civil oppression, I don't want it. If peace means complacency adjusted to deadening status quo, I don't want peace. If peace means a willingness to be exploited economically, dominated politically, humiliated, and segregated, I don't want that peace. So, in a passive, nonviolent manner, we must revolt against this kind of peace. So, the things that Black Lives Matter does, raising attention and consciousness about the war that's being waged against communities of color through criminalization, through political marginalization, through dispossession and displacement, you know, things exactly that King would be right next to us doing. And in terms of, concern about particular tactics, there's nothing in Black Lives Matter that says that we hit the street strapped with guns or that we're tossing Molotov cocktails. By and large, what we're doing is just shining the light and demanding redress. So King would be standing right next to us.
Okay.
What year was it he said all those things you just talked about?
1956.
Well,
it was reprinted in the Pittsburgh Defender, which was...
Right, this subsequent to that, all the stuff you just saw on the film.
Yep, yep. So
I don't think he ended up that way. I don't think he took on Stokely Carmichael and those guys, and he wasn't Morales, period.
I really don't want to get into a debate about that now in this panel because we've got other questions.
The most recent, I'm talking about the most, what we saw today is way after when he was a kid you're talking about. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but
good.
Still... In the speech, that's the seeds of it. And King is not cannot be removed from the spectrum of Black radicalism that goes back to Frederick Douglass.
I used to be George Wallace's national campaign director. And I've been one of the strongest anti-racists in this state.
Okay, look, I'm not going to get into a debate on credentials here. I made the statement, and this is what we stand on.
Okay, let me ask a question that's kind of dovetails into that. But I'm going to ask somebody else to answer it, okay, just for perspectives here. One of the most, and this is a comment and the question, one of the most striking comments was that Dr. King not only criticized, but offered and embodied a prophetic yet practical vision for the future. And here's the question. Does America today have an appetite for such vision? And who today offers or embodies such visions? Anybody else? Megan?
Well, I do want to say one thing.
Pick up your microphone.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I do want to say one thing about
the exchange. I think that a lot of these activists today, and King was a good example of this, understood that riots are the protests of the unheard. So I don't think that he was hoping for riots, much like Black Lives Matter is never hoping for a riot or violence. But they never dismiss the people who are rioting as people who don't have a reason to be upset, and that's how they're expressing that. I was still thinking about that. What was the question again?
Now, what was it I said? Yes. Okay, just the question at the end of the comment, because we were talking about America today have an appetite for such a vision, like the vision that Dr. King had in this speech. So does it, yes or no? And then I guess if so or not, and who today offers or embodies such visions?
I guess I would argue that more so than ever, I see that appetite among Americans. I think the largest protest that we've ever seen in American history just happened on January 21st, as women converged all over the country to protest the idea of sexist and a misogynist being our president. So I think that there's more appetite than ever before.
Okay, and that could be something that has a lot more to say about it. Anybody else want to tag on to that same question?
I mean, on that question, I think that, my answer is that the answer to that question in my mind kind of parallels what we see in America generally, and that is that it's both and. So there is simultaneously great appetite for that and also great disdain for it. So that both those things occur at the same time. And I think that is a really, really critical lesson, to think about what was going on when King was talking about what he's talking about, and today. I went back and looked up some of the old Gallup opinion polls about King from the time. Really, they started measuring him in the early 60s. And it's worth noting, he was never that popular. Yeah. He was never that popular. Not until well after he was. The same is true of Ronald Reagan, by the way. But King was never that popular. His quote-unquote favorable ratings never got over 45%, right? So, he peaked, and he peaked in 65. Part of what I think is critical about this kind of gathering is to debate these ideas about precisely what his position was on violence, because I think that there is great misunderstanding of where King and how King understood violence, even as a pacifist. I think there's great misunderstanding of what he stood for, what ideas he advocated for, and what ways. And I loved Cornel West's talk about Santa Claus, right? That once we kind of pull him out of that, then we can get somewhere.
Okay, thank you. Now, even, I have the microphone, so I can say this. I want to carry that on a step further here and ask, is there anybody today who can follow Martin Luther King in his opinions as expressed here? Anybody want, but...
We got to get out of this great man thing.
Thank you.
Martin would have been nobody if there wasn't a movement that was begging to be born. And the civil rights movement didn't just suddenly pop up in 1955. It had been building since 1930. I direct folks who have any background in sociology to the work of Doug McAdam, wrote a book called The Political Process Model, and the Civil Rights and Black Liberation Struggle, 1930 to 1970, where he basically lays out that, everything builds on what happened before. There would have been no Martin, no Malcolm, no H. Rapp Brown, no Stokely Carmichael without the movement that shaped them, that they in turn shaped. So it's a dialectical process. We've got to get out of the great man stuff. Right now, you asked about who has a vision. Actually, in its principles of unity, we affirm all Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter lays out a vision where we're talking about things like diversity, restorative justice, globalism, you know, understanding that our struggle here is connected to struggles elsewhere, having a value in collective, operating as community, empathy for other struggles that parallel ours, supporting black families, and a whole lot of stuff talking about affirming gay, lesbian, transgender people. There's a vision there. So it's not just a protest movement about abusive policing. It's talking about a vision for a future where there's no necessity for police.
Well said, thank you. It's interesting from my perspective, standing up here watching heads shake yes with what our panelists are saying. So thank you for that.
One of the most wonderful parts about Black Lives Matter is the intersectionality. So that really does, at its foundation, say that there cannot be another great man behind this next movement.
Yes. All right. Thank you. Okay. Next question. Moving on. And this one is for David Matos. How does King's speech apply to U.S. foreign policy today?
Well, I covered that a little bit, and I'd be happy to repeat it. You know, he does take on militarism specifically in the speech. And militarism is something that we are so immersed in the United States of America. Prior to, you know, just a few years prior to King's speech, we had Dwight D. Eisenhower on his farewell speech warning us about the unwarranted influence of a military-industrial complex. And so, you know, if you think about it today, we laud our veterans, but do we remember the victims of the Iraqi invasion? We don't do that. So we're so immersed in that militarism. And from what King was talking about, it's almost indefeatable. Let's take a look at what happened. You know, we invaded Iraq. We're still embroiled in Afghanistan. We spent trillions of dollars. Now, what does that mean for us here at home? There's an opportunity cost to those wars. That opportunity cost is that we cannot build the more just society we want here at home. It's just like King talked about in his speech, that money that is needed to build a just society here at home is being siphoned off into the war machine. And if we don't confront the war machine, we're going to continue on this path. And furthermore, our bombs away kind of means of dealing with terrorism is pouring gasoline on the fire. And like I said, if you put terrorism in the place of communism in King's speech, everything he said is applicable today. So what's the alternative from King's speech that we can say? We need to provide a positive, justice-based response to our own foreign policy. We know that just after the Twin Towers were attacked, the American people asked the right question. They asked, why do they hate us? And we got a sock stuffed in our mouth. They hate us for our freedoms, which is a nonsensical answer. We have a bloody foreign policy that we have to come to grips with, and we have to realize that, you know, it's happening today again. It's happening today in Yemen. We're causing a famine today in Yemen. We've helped Saudi Arabia kill thousands of innocent people in Yemen. That's not going to stop terrorism. That's going to cause terrorism, and that happens in the other places that we're at, too. So we need to come to grips with our foreign policy. And we need to realize that, you know, we can defend ourselves against people that want to attack us, but as long as we try to bomb other countries, we're causing a bigger problem. We're pouring gasoline on the fire. And I think King's speech can be instructive in that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, David. Next question, and this goes back a little more and ties up the time of Dr. King and how it leads into today. And this is for Dr. Crockett. In what ways did King's emerging international sensibilities put him in conflict with the Cold War liberals of his day? And what lessons do we take from that?
You know, one of the things that I was joking a little bit earlier before we started that in preparation, I had to go back and pull my King book off the shelf and blow some of the dust off it. I hadn't really been in this bad boy for a while. But I had a chance to go back through a number of his speeches from that period. And it's great to sort of think about Riverside as part of really a suite of speeches that he made beginning in 61, where, you know, one of the things about the Riverside speech is that it's a better speech to read than it is to hear. You know, I mean, we know Martin as the great orator and the, you know, and the you know, his dialogue and the flow and the rhythm that, and you really, you don't get so much of that in this. It's one of the reasons that it's one of the few speeches you only hear little snippets at a time, and they're rarely strung together, because as a speech, it's not great oration. It departs from some of those speeches in how specific it is. And he had a number of speeches that sort of built up to this kind of climax at Riverside that were all about a kind of religious critique of American exceptionalism. It was a burgeoning critique of what we would now call neoliberalism, right? And so he's really beginning to pull these things into place. Everything that David just said about militarism, King is bringing an international critique to the way that American exceptionalism, our belief that we are God-ordained to do whatever we want across the, we're supposed to run it like we're Adam, right? And so King comes up with this critique of this, and he talks about how it is inherently violent, right? And he does that from the perspective of not just a Christian person who has a sort of belief in a modernist Christianity, but he's also talking about this from the perspective of being a global citizen, right? Not just a citizen of America who's only interested in the next congressional election, right? But somebody who is interested in and speaks for a fraternity of all people. And so this kind of internationalism you see growing really after about 1960 or 61. I don't know what to attribute it to, but it's something that comes through, and it really is the pinnacle you get is at Riverside. And that is the thing that really changed how a lot of people, they had to, when King goes there, you have to have a reaction to it, right? And so the reaction that he got from a lot of those people was disappointment, right? Because now you're messing with our money, right? You know, that becomes a huge problem, not just, you know, with people who are powerful in government and in business, but also people in the movement.
Thank you. Yeah, applause is fine, yes. okay, this next question, and sometimes I choose these out of my stack here just based on how they might fit in with what just went on. And this one I'm going to direct to Ty. And you'll see some similarities here, but it'll give you a chance to express your opinions. How were the triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism expressed in subsequent organizing efforts around civil rights, anti-war, and anti-poverty?
Actually, I wish we had done a better job with that. The Poor People's Movement was supposed to pull together all those strains coming out of the Where Do We Go From Here speech, where he talked about going out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring opposition to racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. The March on Washington, Poor People's March, was supposed to pull all that stuff together and then hopefully launch a multiracial, multi-front movement to deal with those issues. What happened instead is with King's assassination and the fact that nobody could really step up to the plate with the kind of gravitas necessary to move things forward, and we still hadn't gotten to the point of understanding what Ella Baker had warned folks about, the necessity of leader group-centered leaders rather than leader-centered groups. Nobody was able to pick that up, and the movement fragmented and then started to compete with each other for different parts of it. So it became a single-issue anti-war movement, and we saw that in the 80s when some of us attempted at the 82 march on the UN, which was put out as a disarmament anti-nuke march. We tried to introduce the idea of dealing with Palestine, and we were soundly rejected. So we actually had to create within that front a splinter group called the Third World and Progressive People's Coalition, which I was part of, which took up the question of racism here and the racism inherent in the treatment of Palestinians in the Middle East. And they tried to ice us on the thing. In fact, Jules Feiffer came out with a cartoon accusing us of being police agents. Now, Black Lives Matter, to some degree, Occupy Wall Street, have attempted to try and pull those strings together. But it's still not something that's popular because we're still stuck with this thing of who is the leader, with the assumption being that there has to be one person that you can point to as responsible. And I hope we've gotten smart enough now after seeing our history that if there's one person that's looked at as responsible, that person has just painted a bullseye on their head.
Right.
So it's better to have a diverse and dispersed leadership focused on the questions and focused on the principles of movement and centered around building movement than movements focusing on anointing a leader and raising up. So, you know, that's my take on where things are. And that's why I say, for me, BLM is the group that has the most potential of actually creating the kind of momentum around those issues and the intersection of those issues than any other group that I can think of offhand.
All right, thank you. Yes, you're... Tom, you can be in charge of applause. Okay. Right. Okay, now, there's a question here that kind of came out of left field, but I think I want to ask it anyhow, and I don't really know who to direct it to, but, you know, what I remember about the 60s is that, and I know they say if you remember it, you weren't there, but that's not the thing here. There's an awful lot controversy went on and unanswered that came out of the 60s. But this question... And let's see, maybe I'll go with Megan first, okay? And you can pass this on if you want to. Do you think that the U.S. government has any kind of role in the assassination of Dr. King due to his stance against the war in Vietnam?
Even if I had an opinion about that, even an informed opinion... I was thinking when we were watching the documentary, that most of my students today don't have an opinion on the 60s, right? They don't know what you're talking about when you mention the Vietnam War. They don't know, I mean, the music is something that they hear kind of sampled in different ways and completely out of context. And I guess... And if they would have asked, and they often ask me, though, kind of who killed John F. Kennedy. And my answer is always, I don't care right now, right? Because what we're here to talk about is how his death changed America. And if we found out that it was the Cubans or the CIA, it would be great for a historian to tap into that and write that book, and he'd be a millionaire. But how did it change? And so I guess I would say... It would be a great thing to find out, but I don't think it changes anything about his impact on America today. That's my opinion.
All right. Well said. Anybody?
David? I'll just quickly add, I perfectly agree. And part of the reason that it doesn't matter is because we know from declassified documents that the FBI wanted him dead, right? They made no bones about it. And so motive has been established. And even some efforts in that regard, even if not outright assassination. So in some ways, the question of who pulled which trigger under what circumstances is somewhat tangential to this large question of, you know, how that death changed things.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Next question. Let me address this. Let me give this one to David.
Okay.
Do you think that Martin Luther King reevaluated his position in light of the Black Power movement that followed?
I think it was clearly the challenge to his nonviolent ideology that there were people saying that violence was at times necessary. Now, I think that was what the Robust challenge was. And as the movie clearly showed, I think, you know, the one thing that does come through from the speech is, hey, I cannot go on and say violence is the wrong way to go when violence is the American way and America is the greatest purveyor of violence and has had such a violent history, and we have to recognize that. And so, you know, the Black Power movement, I think it would be a mistake to categorize it necessarily as, I think a lot of people saw it as possibly violent at the time, but I think that they were seeking power to, defend themselves and secure their position. So I think it was the necessary challenge did come from conversations with people, radicals, who said violence is necessary, and people who may have been part of the Black Power movement said, hey, sometimes we might need to, use guns to secure our freedom. And that provided the ideological challenge to his nonviolence that he needed to reframe and re-express and convince people, okay, this is why nonviolence is necessary. This is why speaking out against the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence is necessary. So was he challenged? Absolutely. Did it get him to reevaluate? No, I think it got him to, build the underpinnings of his nonviolence and make them even stronger.
Okay, thank you. Next question, and I think I will direct this one back to Ty. Do you think that this speech damaged his effectiveness with regards to the civil rights movement?
I don't believe so. To the extent that other folks are trying to distance themselves from this speech, but this is the period I came up. This is when I was radicalized. You know, I was drafted in 1968, a week after the Tet Offensive. I burnt my draft card in 67. At the Spring Moog on April 15th, when King came back to New York and joined the march with Stokely Carmichael, Dr. Spock, Floyd McKissick in Central Park. That was my point of, final radicalization. Prior to that, I'd been mostly working in anti-poverty stuff in New York as part of a community action program in the Bronx. With that march and that speech, I made my decision that I had to take a stand on the draft and the war, even though my father could never understand why I did that, because due to a football injury, I was, not going to be drafted anyway. I had no hip socket, so I wouldn't be drafted. But I kept getting thrown out of induction physicals on purpose so that I could do draft counseling within the induction center, which earned me a reputation. So in terms of King's effectiveness, it kind of broadened things because it allowed me to see these connections, and that's what launched me down the road of being an absolute anti-capitalist. When he started talking about economic exploitation, poverty, extreme materialism, all of that said capitalism to me. There's a whole generation of Black activists fighting for justice in Black communities that hold an anti-capitalist perspective that is okay, is given the imprimatur, this is okay to hold, by Dr. King. It's hard to be a Black capitalist and say you're fighting for the Black community.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll add, though, he does lose. You're right, he radicalizes, particularly the Northern and Western civil rights activists, but he loses a lot of the northern white liberals who had been supporting him. And this is about the time that he is in the North organizing there and losing those folks anyways, because just like today, people like to point at the South and say, oh, what a backwards place. So glad that this doesn't happen here. But now, you know, Martin Luther King was up north saying, this is segregation and poverty exists here too. And he was losing a lot of white politicians that he previously had the support of.
Yeah, actually, let me add a little piece to that. In 1963, Norman Podritz wrote this paper, My Negro Problem and Ours, where he basically said that the civil rights movement had made this weird turn against its principles of Americanism and liberalism by demanding group rights instead of individual rights. And he went into this long screed about that. So we were already losing the Northern liberal intelligentsia in 63 because they couldn't understand how in this country, oppression has never come down just on individuals. It's come down on the groups that individuals identified in. And you can see this to this day where people who say that they hate niggers always know one group, one family of niggers down the road who are good people, but the rest of them aren't. So that's this individual collective dichotomy. We can oppress a collective, but there are some good individuals.
Just very quickly, too, on this, because I think this point is critical, that part of what we saw in the film is this developing narrative about kind of this inflection point with King. He delivers Riverside, and then he suffers great loss. And I think that's not wrong, but it's also maybe not quite as accurate as it needs to be. And part of our job, hopefully today, is to shed some light, because I think what's crucial there is that, again, you had been seeing the leaking of support go on for quite some time. Like, even in, you know, 64, the Nobel Peace Prize year, his favorability ratings were simply not that high. His unfavorability ratings were actually fairly high. And so he had come on the scene, you know, at least in terms of what they're measuring. He had been on the scene in the 50s, but in 63, they start measuring him. You know, he never peaks that high, and the unfavorability ratings just keep going up and up and up. And so this notion that everybody was in and then they left is nonsense. He did lose a lot, but 67 at Riverside became the point where it was okay for people to abandon him. That's different than the narrative that we're hearing. 67 is when they left him, not when he left.
I'll jump in real quick.
Okay.
So one of the things that King said in defending the speech was, I know that justice is indivisible. And it's this idea, if we were to judge it just by the civil rights movement, yes, he suffered some from coming out and speaking out against the Vietnam War and speaking for justice. But what would he have given up if he hadn't spoken out and laid out that blueprint and said those things? The bigger movement of justice would have lost out. So if we're just looking at the civil rights movement, we're looking at only part of the picture, and we're not looking at the big picture, and the big picture is peace and justice altogether. And that's why this speech may have appeared to be a loss, but it was an enormous victory for the long term because he was able to put these ideas out there that needed to be out there.
All right, thank you all. I got to tell you that one of my problems here in assigning these questions is that those that are about the Vietnam era, that it would be helpful if you were there to answer them. You know, I don't see many of these folks up here who were there like I was there. Okay, so I'm going to ask one question here, and I'm just going to throw it out for whoever wants to answer it. And that is, do you think? What?
That was my war.
Yeah, Ty was there.
That was my jam.
I'm just giving you a compliment here, Ty. That's all I'm doing. All right, then this is directed to you. Did this speech in any way change the opinions of the nations of the world with regards to U.S. commitment to the Vietnam War?
As I remember it, in 68, things were jumping off in France, tied to the Vietnam War and the student movement that was challenging de Gaulle and the support of the French government for the war. And if folks remember, our engagement in Vietnam was because of the French defeat in Vietnam, you know, 10 years earlier. And if you go back a little bit further, the context for that defeat, French defeat, was in 1945 when General Stilwell entered Vietnam as part of the Far Eastern Command. He met with Ho Chi Minh, who presented the constitution that they had worked up, which was modeled after the U.S. Declaration of Independence. And that's because for the time that the Japanese occupied Vietnam and used the French as their resident overseers because of the Vichy government, they had been fighting a war for years and felt that this was a war of independence, anti-colonial war. We've won our independence. And Stilwell said, well, sorry, we're giving the place back to the French. So it was a direct slap in the face in terms of anti-colonial movements. The things that follow after that, that whole period from 1945 until well into the 60s, is characterized by an anti-colonial struggle in the Third World. And that's where this kind of speech with somebody who's a leader in the United States, as far as folks could see internationally, because as soon as Birmingham went international, everybody knew who Martin Luther King was. For him to come out and say that, and these anti-colonial leaders to hear that, you know, this was additional encouragement. We're on the right track, and this is, you know, understand that the U.S. government is not this great bringer of goodies to us and civilization to us, was really confirmed in their minds. So I'm not sure that you could say that the European powers were happy about this thing, but certainly folks coming up in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America heard it and said, this speaks to our reality. This is what we know. And we're glad that somebody in the United States is actually saying this.
All right. Thank you. Follow up.
Just to add to, because that's a great point. It's so critical to take from that. He adopts their language, which is right. The point that Ty raises. I mean, he uses their language. He uses the language of revolution throughout and specifically juxtaposes it to the language of revolution that is in our Declaration of Independence and talks about how we are not living up to that. And so he then in turn takes their language of revolution, and it's so important to he's in dialogue with those revolutionary powers and in dialogue with folks in this country. There's a great scene in one of the Eyes on the Prize films that is about him coming out. It's the one that's in series two. It's about war. I was trying to think of it earlier. He's talking on the phone to Stokely Carmichael the day before the Riverside speech and saying to Stokely, you know, you're going to be a good Christian and be in church on Sunday. And Stokely says to him, now, you know, I don't believe in your stuff, but I'll come hear you preach. You make me tap my feet. And so he says, Stokely, I'm going to come out against the war at Riverside tomorrow. And this is in Stokely's rendering, and he says, you know, I was silent for about 10 seconds and says, I will be there to hear you speak on the front row. So he's talking to a very particular audience with this speech, and that is part of the brilliance of it.
Also, by this time, before Martin does the speech, you know, folks, I'm sure have heard the slogan, well, maybe not, hell no, we won't go, coming from folks who were opposing the draft. What a lot of folks assume is that Tom Hayden or Abby Hoffman or Jerry Rubin or one of the white activists said that. Actually, it was Cleveland Sellers, a member, a SNCC activist, who said that when he came out of his induction center and stood on the steps and said, I've just refused induction, I'm burning my draft card. And then he says, hell no, we won't go. And it picks up as a chant.
Okay, thank you. This question, I think I'll direct this to Megan, because this is within your lifetime, definitely. Okay. In the film, we saw the clip about Obama when accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. He had a slight disagreement with Dr. King when his Vietnam speech. What do you think the impact of that might have been toward pacifists as well as the militants in the civil rights movement?
Well, I think that was one of the first of many moments where a lot of activists realized that they'd been let down by, or they were going to be let down by President Barack Obama, that he wasn't everything that we'd all kind of placed our hopes on. And that is what happened over and over again. And that's all that activists can say now. In fact, I would argue that most believe that we put so much hope into this great man for 8 years that we didn't do a lot of the hard work that we should have been doing for the past 8 years, because we were really pinning our hopes on Barack Obama to transform America into be the change, right?
Yes, we can. Mm-hmm. Any follow-ups on that?
Actually, some of us. I came out of Boston. I was in Boston in 2004, protesting outside of the DNC in their free speech area that they walled us off into. And when I heard Barack Obama's One America speech, the first thing that popped up to me was, where the hell has he been? You know, there is no Black America, there is no White America, where have you been? I've been living in Black America all my life and basically fighting with White America, or the idea of White America, for all my life. So in 2004, when he finally declared himself to run in 2007, the first thing that popped to my mind and what I started using in all my email listservs was, here comes the great white hype.
I thought Cornel West actually did a really good summation, in the sense of kind of understanding what you're getting, right? There are politicians and there are prophets. And I think we have great temptation to blur the lines between those things. And we are often rudely reminded that they are not the same things, and they do not have the same goals. Doesn't mean that they're not both useful, you know, but understand what their limits are.
Okay, thank you. Next question, and let's see. David, why don't you handle this one? In not only this speech, but in others, Dr. King referred to the disproportionate levels of Black men lost in Vietnam. Do you think that him talking about this compromised his initial objection to war in general? And I think what this question is talking about here is, like, yeah, okay, it is racial. It's not war at all. How do you think he really felt about that? And was there a compromise?
No, I think it was more he was keenly aware of that wrinkle and how it was affecting the African-American community itself. And there's this situation where there's this hypocrisy of being sent to fight a war for freedoms that you don't have. So I don't think it really derails his nonviolence arguments or his critiques of war, but it does show that he has his own community, African-American community, that he's championing is directly affected by this. And, you know, also directly affected by the money that's been taken away from programs that were meant to address racial and economic oppression over the years. So he comes from a community that's directly affected, and he's pointing that out. Does that undermine his arguments of nonviolence? No, it just shows that he understands that how he and his people are directly affected.
Okay, thank you. All right, now it's getting close to time to wrap this up, and I have another question that I'm going to throw open with as much response to this, and this goes back to just the whole concept of how he conceived the speech, how he presented it. How do you think he rationalized this speech? Surely he realized that ideological differences in nations perhaps inevitably lead to military conflict, beyond the basic thou shalt not kill. Anybody particular want to?
I'll start. I don't believe, so I hate the word splice. Rationalization just kind of rubs me the wrong way. I don't think that he would accept the notion that nation states sort of inevitably get to the point of having war. That was not something that I accept as a premise when Barack Obama said it. I didn't think that that was a hard truth. I think that's a justification, quite frankly. And I think that King's particular critique of the military-industrial complex made that much clearer, that this was not some self-protective mechanism. This was business.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments on that?
I believe, you know, King was very aware of the reaction that was going to come from this. And in the speech, he does talk about, you know, fighting communism, but in a different way. So there's he recognizes that there's an ideological clash between communism and capitalism, but I don't think he's quite ready to come out and say capitalism is a crock at that point. But, you know, he does recognize that there's a clash and that there are times when you need to push back against other ideologies. He learned that by doing the civil rights movement work in the South. There was two different ideologies, white supremacy versus democracy, you know, and he understood that. So in doing the speech, recognizing that folks are going to react by the fact that he's not making this blanket condemnation of communism and saying that we have some sort of moral imperative to crush that system, you know, he understood that there was going to be pushback, but it was also absolutely necessary if you want to move to a position of peace and mutual understanding. Then you have to understand the conditions that bring certain ideologies to the forefront, and those are rooted in history. And one of the things that he understood is that most Americans don't know their own history. And Baldwin, a few years earlier, had stated that white folks basically are trapped in a history that they don't understand. And because of that, they've trapped the rest of us in reacting to that history. And until folks free themselves from that history, we can't move forward. The same thing with a clash between democracy, in quotes, and communism. Without understanding the history there that backs up those things, it's hard to move to any sort of position beyond that. You know, Russians are very aware that right after World War I, instead of pulling all the troops home, England, the United States invaded Russia. And they're very aware of that in 1919. You know, and that stuck with them. Most folks don't even know that history. So when you see, you know, absolute confrontation between these two systems, it's rooted in the history that we don't even recognize because we've erased it or tried to.
All right.
Just quickly, I think it's worth noting that it hasn't been since Vietnam that we've had, you know, college students who have never known life without America at war, right? I mean, I have students now where it's normalized that we are trapped in a global conflict against terrorism that will just exist for their lifetimes. I think David's got it right, right? I mean, you have to tell them that the cost is not just what we keep hearing from politicians. The cost is our education, social programs, racial justice. I mean, there's a terrible cost that we're not hearing about. And I think that this is exactly what King was attempting to do at that time.
Thank you very much. I see a hand in the back, and Sedge's questions are usually pretty good. Question, comment, is a burning question or comment, Sedge?
Well, it's a comment and a burning question, but not to belabor this wonderful panel. We've heard a lot of history and really open minds about a lot of things about the speech and where Dr. King came from, but the title was A Call to Conscience, and I would like to know who's answering that call and how, it may be for the future discussion, but how we as
It sounds like anybody want to respond to that?
Martin Luther King had another speech where he addressed black power, right? And this was in 1968. And his notion of black power, and I think we could really just talk about this notion of power more broadly, but it was about economic power and political power and using our power as consumers, using our vote, right? I mean, at every turn, we have power, using our voices, but also using our money where we can to make sure that we're supporting the people and causes that need us most.
So a couple of the takeaways from the speech, you know, his big thing is he says that we need to have this revolution in values where we put people above things, profits. You know, whatever those things are, we have a society that's geared toward accumulation and rather than the health and wealth of our people, you know, as a collective. You know, we serve corporations, we serve all these different things. Our politics is geared toward special interests that have deep pockets. We have money politics. And that's something that stands in the way of having a society that's based on putting the people first and people putting human rights first. So that's one of the big takeaways. And the other big takeaway is, you know, we have to confront this war machine, this fact that we're the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. If we don't confront that, we're not going to be able to get to that just society where we put people first. If we don't look at how much money and how many resources are going toward the corporations and the war profiteers and paying for these wars and claw that back and take that back and reclaim that into rebuilding a just society, healthcare, education, all the things that we need to build a just society, that money is being spent. You know, the most recent administration says we should spend $54 billion more on Pentagon spending. Well, we should spend $54 billion more on health care instead. This is a classic example of, you know, a decision we can make as a people, but we have to recognize that we have that decision and we have the power to change that.
I think everybody here can... I think everybody here needs to ask the question, looking at the preamble to the Constitution, where it says, we the people, is who are you talking about exactly? Because when Mick Mulvaney can come out and say he can't justify funding Meals on Wheels or after-school programs for kids to a single mother in Detroit or a coal miner in Appalachia, you have to ask, you know, when you say you're speaking for the American people, who are those folks? Because every survey poll indicates that the American people support programs that help people. When the other hand, when the other shoe or on the other breath, he says, but I can get them to support defense, even though we spend more than the next 10 big spenders in terms of military spending combined. So the question we have to keep asking is, when you say we the people, or when you say the American people, who are you leaving out of that discussion and why?
I'll just add quickly, one of the best answers to Sedge Harmon's question is Sedge Harmon. So for those of you who don't know Sedge, she has been intimately involved in, you know, all of the local activism around ending gun violence in this city. So the answer to her question is herself. It ain't magical, right? There's nothing novel here. We're not going to create some new kind of stuff that hasn't been done. You got to find your lane and get in.
Well said, David, and well said, all of you. All right, well, I want to personally thank you for allowing me to moderate this. This has really been fun to interact with this august panel. So thank you to Linda McLeod and the Social Action Committee of the UUCC, and thank you to David Matos, the director of the Carolina Peace Center. And David, I'm going to give it to you to wrap up here.
I hope this event has inspired you. I hope it inspires you to understand some of King's thoughts that are provocative a little bit more, and I hope you spread those ideas too. Most importantly, I hope it helps you go out there and be one of those voices of conscience that is changing this world and making it a better place. And we got a really wonderful panel here, a really wonderful movie, and go out and carry this work forth, please. Thank you much for being here today.